BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, Anne Scott James, and Dennis Norton. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a wyvern? Either W-I-V-E-R-N, or if you prefer it, W-Y-V-E-R-N.
Well, I like it as a Y myself.
So do I.
And I think, have seen it on top of a gate. This is not a live thing. It's a kind of heraldic creature.
And what kind of creature?
With a tail.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of dragon.
Yep. That'll do. 2 marks it is. A wyvern is a winged, two-legged, which Dillis didn't say, but it is, dragon in heraldry, which has a barbed tail, which looks extremely sharp, and it usually wears in a sort of curve. Now, Dennis Norton, what is a pickerel? P-I-C-K-E-R-E-L, pickerel.
Sounds like a pig who had an affair with a mackerel. I doubt it is. It could be a very fastidious mackerel.
Yes, I'd stick to the water side. This is all right.
I'd stick to the water side.
Wishy-wishy?
It's a fish of some kind, I take it. Yeah.
Okay, 1 out of 2. A pickerel is a young pike, and rel, like cockerel, means it's smaller than its paw. Mm. 1 more. Anne Scott James, what is a cheval glass?
Well, it's a mirror which a horse looks into when it wants to pounce.
Anne, I hope not.
A full-length swinging mirror.
That's it. 2 marks it is. A cheval glass is a full-length mirror in a wooden frame, and it swings between 2 uprights, and it's called a cheval because this is a sort of horse or frame on which the mirror is carried, as opposed to these little tiddly mirrors. Now, Frank Muir. Frank, what is a cachalot? C-A-C-H-A-L-O-T, or if you're frightfully sort of smart, you can call it a cachalot.
I'm still wondering whether a mackerel is a mini raincoat. What was your question?
I should keep off the minis on this one. Cachalot, or cachalot.
It's a misnomer for a mammal.
Yes?
A whale. I say it's a misnomer because whales, in fact, catch very little. They catch sort of plankton in a sort of doormat arrangement in their throat. And the throat is about the size of a man's wrist. And a cachalot is a type of whale.
Yes, I think that'll do. You were getting rather sort of unwarm in what you were saying before, because this is the kind of whale that has a lot of teeth. And the common cachalot is the sperm whale, the Moby Dick kind of whale that Herman Melville wrote about, whereas the ones with the very, very narrow throats, as far as I know, don't have teeth. But before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I hope the 2 women members of the team will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "If winter comes, can spring be far behind?" And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is "a portion of the eternal." And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is odds and ends. 2 marks for correct answers. Dillis Powell, with what poem by what poet do you associate Auburn, and what was it?
Auburn's a place,
mm-hmm,
in America.
Ooh. Hope not.
No.
Sweet Auburn, Village of the Plains.
Mm. Village of the Plains.
Oliver Goldsmith, Deserted Village.
Absolutely right.
Thank you, Frank.
Oliver Goldsmith, Sweet Auburn, Loveliest Village of the Plains. So the plane does come in, but I hope the plane on this side rather than the other side of the Atlantic, I think. Dennis Norton, what would you have done with a dandy prat in the reign of Henry the VII?
I think I...
I was sat around hoping it would clear up quick. Before the National Health, that wasn't it? I presume the same as I would do with it now if I would have had no more idea what it was at Henry VII's time than I do now. Do you know what?
Nowadays, it's become decimalized.
Decimalized?
Decimalized. A coin.
A coin.
You'd have spent it.
That's it. You would? Have an idea.
You'd have spent it.
Give me an idea of its value.
I say it's about threepence halfpenny, give or take, you know.
All right, one out of two. You haven't done too badly. A dandiprat in the reign of Henry VII, he would, I hope, have spent, because it was a small coin issued in his reign, worth about three halfpence. But it was also used of someone who was physically, socially, or morally, or inferior, like a page boy, or a sort of tuppenny halfpenny kind of chap. Dandiprat. Now, Anne Scott James, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, why did Oberon and Titania quarrel?
Quarrel. Oh. Because Oberon fell for somebody else, didn't he?
No. No, it's Titania did.
It was about a page boy, I think.
That's right.
He wanted...
Oh, that's...
A dandiprat.
Yeah.
She wanted his page boy, didn't she? And he wouldn't give it, was that?
One of them wanted the other's page boy.
One and a half out of two. Got it the wrong way around. Titania refused to give up to Oberon a little changeling boy that he wanted to have as a page. One hop. Now, Frank Muir, in what play by what playwright do we find a rich, childless old man pretending he's dying so that he can get costly gifts from his relatives who are anxious he shall name them as his heirs in his will? One of them even sacrificed his wife.
Yeah. Lady in the front row making noises. I can read as Volpone. Would I be near?
Absolutely right.
Ah, both of us. We'll share the mark between us. Volpone by Ben Jonson.
Two marks. Ben Jonson's Volpone. In this round, as he's gradually beginning to run out of real verse and poetry, the compiler of this program has had the temerity to compose some doggerel verses of his own in the form of questions. And the answer which I want lies in the last line. For two marks, then, Dillis Powell, a book about a prisoner in the French Bastille, a prisoner whose identity nobody would reveal, but identifying author and his books, a simple task.
Is that Dumas?
Yes.
It's Dumas. It's a Dumas book.
Chap we don't know who he ever was.
That's it.
The Man in the Iron Mask.
Yes. All right, you get your two marks. But identifying author and his books, a simple task, Alexandre Dumas and the Man in the Iron Mask. Put them together.
It rhymes. It doesn't scan.
No, that's what the... That's what Ted Mason told me, but we hope you wouldn't notice. All right, on to Dennis Norden. A lot of naughty stories of romance were told by gentlemen and ladies in the days of old. You'll find them in a book whose author you should know.
It's always a kind of dirty book. It has to rhyme with O, isn't it? Tell me a dirty book that ends in O.
Put the author at the end of the line. It makes it easier. You'll find them in a book whose author you should know.
Decameron, is it?
Boccaccio. Well done. Yeah. Decameron by Boccaccio.
All right, two marks it is. You'll find them in a book whose author you should know. It was titled The Decameron by Boccaccio.
There's again a syllable missing.
No.
Yeah. It's about me by Fred Boccaccio. Scan. Yeah.
Now, Ian Scott James. The name of a king and the name of a writer, the former was tragic, the latter much lighter. They've both been applauded by people for years.
I'm speaking, of course, of A Couple of Lears.
That's it.
Well, that scans, anyway.
Scans very well, Anne. Well done. So take off your hats to the two famous Lears. Lears. The first was King Lear, and the second was author of nonsense rhymes, Edward Lear. Frank Muir. Tarquinius Superbus had a son who had no shame. His parents called him Sextus, was a most appropriate name. He pursued a highborn lady, and he simply would not cease.
So it all ended merrily with the rape of Lucrece.
Before we get any further, I'll give you your two marks straight away. an alternative version of the last line and was immortalised by Shakespeare in The Rape of Lucrece. Well done. I think team's done jolly well on those four. Now we have a round of slang terms. 2 marks for correctly identifying these expressions or for making a reasonably worthwhile guess. Dillis Powell, do lally tap.
Round the bend.
That's it. Round the bend it
round
is.
Round the bend.
Do you know what it comes from?
I haven't a notion, have you? Nope.
It means round the bend, a bit crazy. And it was a regular army slang word from the Indian Army. Deolali in Bombay was a place where they had a sanatorium. And the word tap in Hindustani meant fever. So army chaps put the two words together. It meant you were balmy, mentally ill, ill enough to go into this particular sanatorium. Dennis Norden. Gut scraper.
Sounds like the title of a new television series, isn't it? Dennis Norden, gut scraper. Next week's thrilling adventure. Well, it's one of those pieces of slang that nobody ever says.
Mm-hmm.
It's reputed to be a violinist, but I've never heard anybody refer to a gut scraper, a violinist, a gut scraper.
I would agree with you entirely, Dennis. 2 marks. It is supposed to be for a violinist, but I pretty much have anybody had ever heard it. Cat gut scraper, you see.
I see, Jack.
Sorry, that was for my own benefit. I forgot. And Scott James, I'm afraid this one is American. Cookie pusher.
Well, a cookie's a biscuit.
Mm-hmm. Cookie pusher.
Chapel
well, clock. Somebody who flogs biscuits, I should think.
A you know, bicky flogger.
A grocer.
No, in a very particular sense, you're right, but not in the sense of selling them.
It makes you acquire the taste for
look,
them.
There aren't many things you can do with a biscuit,
and,
Jack.
That'll be reprinted in The Listener.
And you're at the White House when this is happening.
Ah, one of those waiters in a white mess jacket which they wear in America. Must be. A waiter.
One.
Somebody who hands those little snacks, those little canapes,
that's it.
You have with your drink.
Well done. Cookie pusher means a very, very junior diplomat whose most difficult duty is to pass round the plates of food at diplomatic functions in the White House and elsewhere.
British ambassador does it now.
All right, Frank Muir. Dutch comfort.
Dutch is a word one always applies when one doesn't like whatever is applicable to the phrase. It derives from the time when we didn't like the Dutch.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we had Dutch concerts and Dutch courage.
Yes.
And Dutch comfort presumably as being a sort of Job's comforter, saying, oh, we've got a pimple, my aunt died of that.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well done, Frank. Dutch comfort implies, oh, well, it might have been much worse. That is, however bad the evil that's come to you, a worse evil is certainly conceivable and might be just round the corner. This was Dutch comfort, or sometimes called Dutch consolation.
Got a tummy ache, you'll have to have a gut scraper.
Now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Dillis Powell, can you give me the origin of the quotation, if winter comes, can spring be far behind?
It's one of those puzzles in rhyming. It says, oh wind, if winter comes, can spring be far behind. Or oh wind, if winter comes, can spring be far behind.
That's
and
what
it's
I think.
Shelley.
Yes.
And it's Ode to the West Wind.
Well
that's
done.
The last two lines.
Or wind.
Well done.
Or wind.
Now, Anne Scott James, can I have the origin of your quotation? A portion of the eternal.
Well, I think it's Shelley too.
It is.
Are you asking about the poem?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Adonais.
Yes, absolutely right. 2 marks you get. Hold on. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir. If winter comes, can spring be far behind?
A few weeks ago, I had to go to Moscow for 5 days to talk to a Russian. I had to take Nina Foud with me as interpreter. I also took my wife, Polly. So the three of us went off, and I want to tell you a little about this trip, really for warning, because lots of you will probably be going next winter, and a few hints and tips and wrinkles might come in useful. I won't tell you about the political atmosphere in Moscow. I mean, we can take that as read. I want to... Now, when you get to your hotel, you'll find the loo doesn't work. Or rather, it overworks. Because what happens is all Russian loos seem to be made by the same firm. And they're sort of low-level things with a cistern which you can get at. And they run the whole time. And what you do is, you lift the porcelain lid with your right hand, you dip your left hand into the water, and there's a sort of rubber seating valve thing, and you press that firmly down, and it stops running. Now, coupled with that is a second tip. A little way up the Gorsky Prospect, just to the right, there's a jeweler's shop which will dry out a wristwatch. In about 5 or 6 weeks. But the biggest tip I can give you, and the most important one, is this cold question. That Moscow in February is very cold. It can be sort of minus 20, minus 30. And you can hire clothes, as indeed I did. A fur-lined coat, a big hat, a fur hat with floppy earpieces, and long john underwear. And these work really, on the whole, pretty well. The steward in the aircraft gave me a tip. He said, always wear your fur hat and always wear it with the ear flaps down and firmly tied under your chin. And it does keep you very warm. You tend to sort of roll about a bit on the pillow because it's quite fat. But you are certainly very warm. And when you're outside in the cold, it isn't too bad, except for one fallacy in this whole clothing business. Now, all coats have a slit up the back, which can blow open. All jackets have a slit up the back that can blow open. And the extraordinary thing about long johns, these sort of winter weight consoles, is they also have an aperture at the back. So when you're on the Red Square, bending down, there is nothing between you yourself personally and the east wind from Siberia but the crease in your trousers, the seam of your trousers. And that is a sort of dotted line when you come to think about it. It's not solid cloth. There are just stitches between you and the east wind of Siberia. Quite a good tip is to take a second fur hat with you. Then, in the privacy of your own bathroom, before dressing in the morning, get a shallow basin and some flour and water, and you mix these up together and put them on one chair. And on the second chair, you get your second hat and a pair of scissors, and you snip off the fur, and you fill the second basin with the fur, and then sit in basin A. Walk around a bit, and when tacky, sit in basin B. You will then be fully protected against the Siberian wind. So in other words, my chief advice to you is take no chances. Now, these long john underwear, these winter weight combs, they can spring open with the ordinary movements of walking. So take my advice. And in fact, Shelley expressed it terribly well. If winter comes, can spring, be fur behind.
Very glad to report that Frank has fundamentally recovered from his visit to Moscow.
Spasiba.
Well, now we go back to the other quotation, Dennis Norton's. If you remember, that was a portion of the Eternal.
I was hoping he'd defected.
The other three things which bother me most in life, I think, are having my hair cut, which I can't stand, buying socks, which somehow I feel is a waste of life, and putting my car in for servicing. Now, I'm not sort of being plutocratic about that, you see, because I use my car as a kind of mobile attic. Any item or object that I feel I might need during the course of a day's living, I just sling in the back of the car and keep it there. So you can imagine, when it goes in for servicing, I very badly feel the lack of it. Now, you may well ask that, feeling as I do about being parted from the car, you say, well, why don't you service it yourself then? The answer is because I happen to be the least mechanically minded person in the world. I have difficulty understanding the principle of the wheelbarrow. So when the car starts exhibiting symptoms, you know, that terrible loss of power, I find all kind of fruitling reasons to try and keep it going, you know, make it, like emptying the ashtrays. I do actually get my car into such a state that if I empty the ashtrays, I can do 3 more miles to the gallon. But there comes a moment when you just have to put it in and have something done about it, as happened last week. And at this particular time, I'm working out of a film studio, and they start this ungodly hour of the morning. So when I put my car in this time for servicing, I hired a car. Now, I'll give you a tip about hiring a car. Always test them first. Otherwise, you won't get in the position that I'm in at the moment with this Mini. It has no reverse. The reverse gear doesn't work at all. It won't go backwards. Now, do you understand what this means in terms of life? It means I have to approach everywhere in a circle. You see what I mean? As I can't go backwards, any place I arrive at, I must arrive at it pointing in the direction in which I intend to leave. And you get a lot of mileage that way. I was looking at one of those Back Britain posters that said, don't go abroad for your holiday this year. Aren't there parts of Britain that you haven't seen yet? And I thought, not many. And I thought, so there must be another way of coping with this problem of a car that won't go backwards. And I had this idea. You know, when you take your driving test, they make you do a thing called a U-turn. And for some reason, you have to be able to do this in order to drive. I thought, well, that doesn't take into account what happens to you if you have a car that can't do a U-turn because it won't go backwards. Why don't they make compulsory an O-turn? You see, because then, if you find a nice wide road, you just make an O-turn without reversing, and you're pointing back the way you came. I'm going to publicise this, and Shelley's been called on very greatly, actually, for publicisation purposes, but I thought you could say that, in his words, if a U-turn won't help, a portion of the O-turnal.
By your vote, ladies and gentlemen, the contest of the two stories is won by Frank Muir, and Frank Muir and his partner, Dillis Powell, also win the entire contest by 1.5 marks, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.